Welcome to Newsworthy with Norisworthy. Get ready for some awesome.
Welcome to Newsworthy with Norisworthy. Today we have on the line Mr. Rick Atchley. So Rick, welcome to the show.
Hey Luke, glad to be here.
Rick, first of all, I've always wondered, you're the preacher of the biggest church in your denomination or fellowship or whatever you guys like to call it. And you don't have anything special in front of your name. It's just Preacher Rick. Now, if you were, say, like a Methodist, you would be Bishop Atchley. Do you regret not being a Methodist for that reason?
Well, you know, I do think they have a better retirement package. So late in my career, I may have to make a shift. Mm-hmm. But let me tell you, don't think that just because I don't have a title, I'm not called many things.
What's the best thing you've been called?
Oh, I have been called many things. Early on in my career, I was called our cute little preacher. And some of the things I've been called lately probably aren't fit for a podcast. But let me just know, I have received many titles.
That's outstanding. That's outstanding. Now, one of the things that was the highlight of my first 3 or 4 years of ministry was an email I received from someone who's a member of your church, an old college roommate of mine named Ryan Ware. And he emails me and he goes, Luke, I think Rick stole one of your stories in his sermon. And what it was is I had written something about my mother-in-law working with an oil executive's sister. And she was complaining or worried about her retirement. And there's some joke about, you know, when that's your brother, your retirement's going to be fine. And you use my illustration. And I emailed you and you said, well, you know what, Luke, you should feel proud because I didn't say some preacher punk told me this story. You said one of my preacher friends. Now, I've always wondered, since you're willing to admit that you stole that one illustration from me, since then, what percent of your sermons do you think you've actually stolen from my stuff?
Well, Luke, I feel like I can say with all authenticity that I don't even recall stealing that. In fact, I think your mother-in-law sent me the story because she wanted it to be used by someone that would actually have an audience.
Wow. Wow.
Having said that, I will say that I think you're a great preacher, and I would be more than happy to steal more of your stuff in the future if you'll send it to me.
Well, you know, I knew my dad actually prefers listening to your sermons over mine. I did not know my mother-in-law was like that as well. Well, with that being said, let's jump right into this. Let's talk about church today. And the reason I have you on the phone is because, or on the podcast, is because, say, for example, Jerry Jones calls me up and says, Luke, I've seen your dominance in fantasy football. I've seen the great critique you have of the Cowboys drafting over the years. And I've decided I'm going to offer you the job as the general manager of the Dallas Cowboys, which would follow with me quitting my job.
But, which, by the way, I would be in favor of.
Well, maybe
even
so.
Even an Eagles fan like you could do a better job than Jerry of running that team.
First of all, I was born in Philadelphia. I'm not an Eagles fan. That's my brother. Thank you very much, though. But if that does happen, which I'm not saying it's not going to happen, I just think there is a possibility. But if it does happen, the phone call that I would most regret having to make is the phone call I'd make to you to say, Rick, I'm not going to be working at a church anymore. Because I don't know anyone who believes as much as you do in the local church, who cares as much about church work as you do. There's just no one else who loves church the way you do. And so my question is, why do you believe in church so much? Where does that belief in what church is, where did that come from?
Well, there's a lot of ways to answer that question on a many levels. So let me start, and I'm going to sound kind of preachy here, okay? But Luke, I really do believe that Jesus loved the church. I really do believe that when he said, I am going to build a church, that he had a vision for a redeeming of things to the way God wanted it to be. And that plan included the building of a church. I read in Revelation, he writes letters to churches. He says, I walk among the churches. There's going to be this wedding. He's inviting his bride, the church, to come to. So I know it sounds kind of preachy, but I start with something that basic, but I think that critical and foundational. And that is, I believe Jesus had a profound, a intense, and a loyal love to the church. And I don't believe he said, I'm going to build a Christian nation, a Christian school, a Christian institution. He said, I am going to build a church. And so So that's where it starts for me, is I think I am in line with the will of Jesus when I try to build a church. I find it very interesting that Paul could pray in Ephesians 3, to him who's able to do imaginably more than we can ask or imagine, to him be glory through Christ Jesus and the church. That's a pretty powerful pairing there, mm-hmm. that somehow God is glorified through the work of Jesus Christ and the church in the restoration of all things to what God has always wanted. So it starts right there for me. It's a theological motivation. I believe in the church because I believe Jesus did.
Yeah, and you get that from the Bible.
Right.
You quote a bunch of different stuff. You quote Jesus, right. You quote Paul, you quote, yeah. quote from Revelation. Have you always been a Bible person like that? Has the Bible always been such a big part of your life?
Well, I think it's fair to say that we're also shaped by our experiences. Like I said, I could have answered the question on a number of levels. Mm-hmm. At an experiential level, the church has been important to me. I didn't grow up in a particular Christian family. There was only one Christian on either side of my family, and that was my grandmother. My mother and father, although they had a nominal profession of faith, they really didn't know how to follow Jesus. And the early years of our childhood, they were hard. In fact, my mother and father eventually separated, and I lived 1 year of my life with my mother, and my father lived in a different city. When my parents decided to try to salvage their marriage, one of the things that they made a commitment to is let's engage in a local church. And so we went from church not really being a part of our lives to we were there on Sunday morning. We were there on Sunday night. And I just gave a hint to how old I am. We were there on Wednesday night. We were there every night of the 7-night-long gospel meeting that really tells you how old I am. Well, except for Thursday night, because that's when my parents had bowling league. My point is that engagement in a local church was a huge part of literally the saving of my family. And so at an experiential level, why do I love the church? Well, I owe a lot to the church. The flawed church, the church with all her problems and all her weaknesses, was a big reason why I am who I am today. So at that level, too, I love the church. And, yeah, it was in those days when we started making church an important part of our family that I began reading the Bible, going to Bible school, and thinking theologically became more a part of my my story. But I guess I have to admit that even before I had theological reasons to love the church, I had a personal or experiential reason. The church rescued my family.
Wow. Didn't you know early on that you wanted to be a preacher? Wasn't that an early thing in your life?
It was. In fact, my mother and father got back together when I was about 6 or 7 years old. And it was about that time that I sensed a call to preach. I announced to the world I was going to be a preacher. And I have no way to explain it except a calling, because it wasn't like there were preachers in my family. There weren't even many Christians in my family. It wasn't even like I knew preachers. Church was pretty new to me.
Yeah.
And so I have no vocabulary other than a call to say I felt like I was supposed to do this. And so, yeah, about that time is when I started announcing to the world. I didn't go through the I'm going to be an astronaut stage. I didn't go through I'm going to be a Dallas Cowboy stage. And that's back when the Cowboys were good. I just always said to the world, I'm going to be a preacher. Now, like almost all ministers, including probably yourself, I've wrestled at times with that call. I've tried to back away from that call, but it's always been there.
Do you think that call is in some way connected with your parents getting back together at the same time you decide, I want to be a part of a church? Do you think that maybe there's part of you that's connecting, hey, this helped bring my family together, so I want to do this for other people, or I owe it to the church for what they've done for my family?
I think probably, Luke, looking back on it as an adult, that is probably a fair and probable speculation. But I was 7 years old at the time. I wasn't smart enough to put all that together. I just said, hey, I think I'm going to be a preacher.
Well, I am glad that you decided to become a preacher. You've been, in a lot of ways, like the godfather of preachers to a lot of us young guys, and we're grateful for that. And so
you've
seen church from being a 6 or 7 year old boy to where you are today. You're a few years older than that now. I'm not going to say the number, but you see, obviously, a great shift in what church looks like from back then to what it looks like today. What do you think some of the more noticeable differences in how church looks now than it did back then?
Well, I think that is a great question. And again, I'm just going to give you my opinions. I think one big shift in church is we've seen less of a emphasis on denominational approaches to church. And we've seen more of a shift to philosophical, I think, lines of demarcation. We're less sectarian, and that's a good thing. I think one of the big shifts I've seen is a generational shift. My generation, I hate to admit this, old enough to be your father, was my generation saw church as a Matthew 28 organization. Go into all the world and make disciples or reach the lost. Your generation sees the church, I think, more as a Matthew 25 institution. Are you going to feed the hungry? Are you going to visit the prisoner? Are you going to clothe the naked? And so my generation saw church's mission primarily as saving souls. And your generation seems more interested in justice and in saving lives. And both are legitimate. And the church is, I think, either strengthened or handicapped when she emphasizes one to the exclusion of the other. I think the great blessing your generation has brought to the church is a reminder of Matthew 25, that we exist to bring life to people, not just life after death, but life. And it begins now. And that includes justice and mercy and compassion. The concern I have for the way your generation is doing church is, it seems to me that in your generation, it's kingdom work, whether or not the king ever gets mentioned. And I would struggle with that a little bit and say it is still always the task of the church to call attention to her head or to her groom. And so I would encourage your generation to continue Matthew 25, remember Matthew 28, and talk about Jesus a little more.
That's a good idea, to talk about Jesus more. What are some of the ways that is practically fleshed out in churches these days that are focusing more on the Matthew 25, whatever you do for the least of these, you do for me text, instead of the Matthew 28 text, making disciples?
For example, when I was young, a mission trip would mean we would go somewhere and we would knock on doors and ask people, if you died tonight, do you know you'd go to heaven? Terrible question, but that's what a mission trip was. Today, a mission trip is to take a bunch of kids somewhere and paint a school. Mm-hmm. And the entire trip, there may never be a single conversation with a single person about Christ. And so that's how it's changed. I would say it's kingdom work to paint a school, but it's kingdom work to paint a school if somehow glory is given to the king while it's happening. So that would be my challenge. But you mentioned changes. There's been other changes too. I think we've seen a healthy conversation over, has the church become too institutional? Should it get back to a more organic understanding of community? And so we're seeing a lot of new kinds of expressions of churches. We see mega churches, but we see house churches. We see satellite campuses, and we see churches that meet in bars and at coffee shops. And frankly, I think part of the genius of the church, when you read the New Testament literature, there's no description of what a church has to look like, how it has to be shaped or formed. Its adaptability to any culture is absolutely stunning. And so I embrace and I'm excited about the new expressions of church, provided, and this is hard, provided it can happen without the condescension that typically takes place in the discussions of what church should look like. Because, of course, everybody knows the way I'm doing church is the best way to do church. And if we can explore new expressions of church without that condescension, I think that'd be a healthy thing.
So where do you see the future of church going? Because there are some people who say it's just a house church. Some people who are saying that the mega church, which is your style of church, is going to eventually no longer have a place in the kingdom. Some are saying it's got to be one or the other, that you see it's going to be the really big churches, and you're going to have like the franchise model where you're going to have, you know, a brain of the hills here and there, and all these other mega churches in each city. And then on the other side, you're just going to have the house church. Where do you see the church in 50 years?
You know, Luke, I don't think I'm going to give you an answer you're going to like. And it is, I don't know. I don't think the mega church is going away. I know it's popular for some circles to critique and to criticize the mega church. But all the research I see says it's doing as well as ever. I don't think it's going to go away. And in fact, it's ironic because you go to Africa or Asia, they would not consider my church a mega church because it doesn't have 50,000 people. And so I don't think the mega church or the large church is going to go away. I think the house church is going to thrive too. I don't know that we're going to be able to bottle up the church and say this style is going away, this style isn't. I think the church is just going to continue to find ways to express itself in ways that reach the culture. I live in Texas. In Texas, we like big. If we're going to build a football stadium, it's going to be the biggest ever. There is always going to be, at least for the foreseeable future in Texas, a place for big gatherings of Jesus followers. That's not going to change anytime soon. I celebrate other forms and expressions of church, house church. As a quote mega church pastor, I'm going to give a critique that I hope doesn't come across as condescending, which I just said is a bad thing. I understand why many people would critique and be suspicious of the church I'm at or the way we do church. I understand that, and it's not for everybody. But it's easy to say, well, it's too institutional. It's easy to say it's no heart. It's all about program. It's easy to do that. But a while back, we had some people leave my church. They were going to get serious about Jesus and just do house church, okay? So they went away just to be house church. Well, 3 years later, they haven't multiplied. They haven't brought anyone to Christ. They get together in their home, and in fact, they're expressing a form of faith that's more self-absorbed than the church they're criticizing. So if that's what house church is, I think it deserves to be critiqued as well. I don't care if it's house church, if it's small church, if it's satellite church, if it's I don't care. I just want to see it make disciples. Yeah. And I think it can happen in all kinds of ways. Here's a word I would give to your generation. I think it's very easy to critique and be disdainful of many forms of church. Church is a flawed place. It's full of flawed people. You know that as well as I do. One of the things that I think your generation has been in some ways a little bit duped by is the notion, well, you know what? I just had to get away from church so I can find Jesus. And it's not hard to get on the website and find all the blogs of all the brilliant young people who said, I'm closer to Jesus than ever now that I've left the church. Here's the problem I have with that. I think we've made an idol of spirituality. I'm going to challenge you. Jesus didn't come to promote spirituality. He came to build a society called the kingdom of God. And when you follow Jesus, it was a communal, it was a corporate call. Jesus discipled people in community. To my knowledge, never gave private discipling lessons. Maybe I'm wrong, but check the Gospels and find a time when he had a one-on-one private discipling. He never sent people on assignments, on mission trips by themselves. Everything about Jesus was building a society through which this mission of restoring all things was going to happen. And so I'm unimpressed with spirituality that dismisses the importance of community. Now, that community can be expressed in many kinds of ways, but it needs to be in community. And I call that church. And if you don't like that word, find a different word. I don't care. But I can't believe that you can produce a follower of Jesus in a way different than he did it.
Yeah.
And he did it corporately.
Yeah. Do you think that emphasis on an individual spirituality is a reflection of our culture? Do you think our culture today is more individualized than it used to be?
Oh, absolutely. Hey, Luke, what was the Oxford Dictionary word of the year for 2013? Selfie.
Selfie?
Yeah, selfie.
Oh, that's...
What is it about this generation that says, I need to take a picture of myself and I need to post it on social media because everybody needs to see the hamburger I'm choosing for lunch. I don't want to sound sarcastic. I mean, I've probably going to take some selfies, okay? But is there any doubt that we have become a more individualistic society? I don't think so. In fact, the New York Times several years ago published an article where Google had posted a database of books published from 1500 to 2008, over 5 million books. And David Brooks did a study of what words were coming into and leaving common usage in publishing. And it was interesting. He said in the last 50 years, you see a increase in individualistic vocabulary, self-actualization, personalized. You see a decrease in communal language, community, common good, share. He said in the same time in the last 15 years, you've seen a decrease in words that speak of moral virtue, honesty, humbleness, decency, faith, even evil. Now, this is David Brooks writing in the New York Times saying he believes there is a correlation between the increase in individualistic thought and vocabulary and a decrease in moral virtue, that they are inextricably linked. And I agree with him. I think it goes all the way back to the word, it's not good for man to be alone.
Mm-hmm.
This life that we're called to is a life can only be maximized when it's done with other people. And by the way, that's one of the reasons why I believe church is critical to a disciple's walk with Christ, because in church I am forced to be with people that are hard for me to love,
yeah,
hard for me to like. It's no big thing for me to say, well, I'm just going to meet at the coffee shop with six people who think just like me and we're going to groove on Jesus. I think we're called to something bigger than that.
Yeah.
I'm called to embrace and I'm called to grow in Christ with people that aren't like me, who don't look like me, who don't think like me, and frankly, don't like me. And there's something healthy about doing life that way, because that is a witness, I think, to the world.
That is a very good reminder of what church is supposed to be. Can I push back a little bit on the David Brooks moral virtue kind of thing? It seems like in the previous generation, there is a great emphasis on moral virtue, and I agree with that. But where is that coming from? It seems like in a previous generation, the church had emphasized the things you're supposed to do. And maybe there is more fear behind that, and there is more sense of duty. And like, if we're going to be a good person, these are things we have to do. And it seems that today there's an emphasis on grace, and there's an emphasis that you are loved just as you are. And we've taken that fear card out of the equation. And so a lot of people in this generation don't have the sense of duty that I have to go to church to punch a time clock. I don't have to be a part of a church for God to love me. And I'm not earning some sort of good standing with God by being a part of church. And do you feel like maybe the greater emphasis on grace has given people a healthier theology, but in giving people a theology that says God loves you just as you are, the sense of duty and fear that has gotten people into the seats at church is therefore causing them to step out of church?
Luke, that's a very interesting assessment, and I think there's some truth to it. Perhaps you're onto something. My pushback would be, have we truly taught a healthy theology of grace if it doesn't require me to be somewhere where I'm going to have to be gracious? In other words, if I can do my walk with Christ in a context where people don't need grace from me and I don't need grace from them, then how grace-centered is my theology anyway? So that would be my pushback, is that it seems to me a healthy understanding of grace ought to drive me, compel me toward people in need of grace and in need of extending me grace.
Yeah, there's something about church that I really I love, that, you know, you go to the beach or the mountains and everyone says, "I see God there." That's just, you see God in beauty. That, like, everyone can do that. But there's something about church where you see it in the darker things, in having to confess your sin to someone. You see it in dealing with the same person over and over again with their same compulsions and their same issues. And that you see beauty not just in nature, but you see it in the ugly parts of life. You see it in a family rallying around someone who's going through a divorce. You see it in someone helping someone while their child is sick. You see beauty in the ugly facets of life when you do church together.
I think you said that well, Greg. You ought to be a preacher. And I think you're absolutely right. Yes, I can see God in a mountain. But there is something powerful about seeing God in the faith of the lady in my church who just lost her husband of 70 years worshiping with her hands raised. There's something that you miss if you don't have a community like that. And I would say, too, you know, the church gathered is the temple of God. And I believe God likes to feel his spirit in his temple. And so there is, I think, an experience of the presence of God when the community is gathered that you miss when you seek God only by yourself. You know, you said a good word there, too, about the need to see and live through the darker stuff together. You know, why does Scripture say confess your sins to each other? Why can't I just get in my closet and confess my sin to God? It's simple. I don't have to humble myself to confess my sin to God. But Luke, I have to seriously humble myself to confess my sin to you. But who does God give grace to? To the humble. So I would say again, any theology or experience of grace is diminished if I'm not walking this life with other people.
Well, what do you say to the person who's gone to church for years? They've been a part of a Christian community, and they aren't getting anything out of it. They say, you know, I go there, but it's really not making a difference in my life. Why do you think they're having that experience?
Boy, that's a whole podcast, Luke. I can't do that in 1 minute. There's a lot. Some churches are unhealthy. Okay, let's be honest. Some churches are just sick and dying. Read the letters to the churches in Asia. Some of those churches were bad, messed up places. Some of it is, Luke, let's be honest, we live in a consumer culture where people come to church too often and they don't even realize, as consumers, not as contributors. They come saying, what can this church do for me? What am I going to get out of being a part of this church instead of what am I going to bring and give? There's part of that. I would say to that person, be patient. Be grace-oriented. Maybe God called you to this community not because you're going to get anything, but because he needs you to give something. And I would say, too, don't let a bad church experience sour you on church. Everybody has had a bad church experience, okay? Jesus went to church one day, and they tried to kill him. Now, I'm pretty sure you've never had an experience that bad, although there have been a few sermons where you thought that might happen. My point is, the church, by its definition, is a collection of people who are seriously flawed and who've admitted it. So you should expect it to have its issues. So most of the time, I'm going to say to that person, be more grace-oriented, be more patient, and go and give. At the same time, I guess I would say, if over an extended period of time, your association with a particular community of faith is causing you to be dry, and it's diminishing your experience of the love of God, then find another community.
What about the person who is a part of a megachurch? You're obviously a megachurch guy, and obviously the straw man argument against megachurches is that, well, they have great programs, but there's no community there, right? So what do you say to that person who's going to a megachurch, and by megachurch we mean a church that's over 1,000 or 2,000 people, and they can't find community? What do you say to that person?
Well, first off, I think it's unfair to say it's just easy. And I think an unfair critique to say, well, if you go to a large church, you can't, they don't care about people. Okay. I grew up in a church of less than 200 people that was cold and unfeeling. My line is, it has nothing to do with the size of the church and everything to do with the size of the hearts of the people that are at that church. I don't believe a church could ever have become a large church if there wasn't something warm and real happening there. But now, I will say this. I think community requires some degree of intentionality. It says in Acts 2, they were devoted to fellowship. And so I do think it means then that I have to engage and make an effort to establish community. And I think one of the mistakes we can make, and I'll be honest, I think one of the fair critiques of megachurches is sometimes we think every answer is a new program. Well, they'll just start small groups and that'll fix it. Well, you could be in a small group and not have community. You could be in a ministry group or a support group and not have community. It takes confession. It takes a humble spirit. And it takes some degree of intentionality to say, I'm going to reach out and I'm going to develop some relationships where I'm real, I'm honest, and where helping each other follow Christ is the reason we're together.
So if you're going to talk to the person who is not connected to a church right now, and they say, you know, we're going to try to go find a church that's going to be our church home, what do you recommend to them? How do they go about doing that process?
First thing I try to say is, again, that the church can be expressed in many ways, and that it is not a – I don't take it as an insult if the way the church I'm at expresses itself is the way that's best for them. I'd ask them to explore many different churches. I do ask them to ask, and I know some may disagree with this, but I tell people when they're, say, leaving my church and they're going to another city and they're saying, do you know of a church in that area? And a lot of times I might do, but sometimes I don't. I say, find a church that's really going to lift up Christ, going to honor him, be about his mission, and find a church that's going to teach the scriptures. Those are the two things that are priorities to me when I look for a church. And I would encourage people looking for a church to think about those two things.
That's good. There's some good advice for everyone to hear. Now, Rick, one of the things I like to do in the Newsworthy with Norrisworthy show is give people a chance to dispel some rumors that are out there. And so there's a rumor that's floating around about you that I want to give you an opportunity just to say true or false, if it's true or if it's false. Now, your roommate in college, some people might have heard of him. His name is Maximus Lucado. Is that right? Am I saying it correctly?
Actually, it's Max Lucado, and we were roommates for part of my college career, not all 4 years.
Okay, so your roommates are part of the career, your college career, with a guy named Max Lucado. Now, there is a rumor floating around that this guy's turned out to be a little bit of an author. He's written a few books, and he sold a few copies of them. The rumor is this, that you had a notebook full of ideas for books to be written, and he stole it from you. Did that happen, true or false?
Okay, that is not true, because honestly, in college, I didn't think he was going to graduate, much less become an author. It is true he never would have passed freshman Greek without me. It is true that he talks in his sleep. And it is true that he's not the only author, that I also have published books. And between the two of us, we've probably sold about 80 million copies.
Wow. So just split right 40 each, right?
Well, I don't know exactly how it breaks down, but I just know that's the cumulative total.
Oh, that's great, Rick. That's great, Rick. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show, Rick. We really appreciate it. And people need to follow you on Twitter, and your church website is thehills.org. Is that correct?
That is right.
Good.
Hey, I've been honored, Luke. I love what you're doing. This is some good stuff.
Hey, thanks, Rick. I appreciate it. Have a good one.
God bless, man. Bye-bye.
Thanks for checking out Newsworthy with Norrisworthy. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You are now adjourned.